everybody. Ethan, please continue on your story.
All right. Well, what we were talking about right before we hit record was that Tim's Twitter game has been on fire recently, which is awesome. Congratulations. I feel like it's just about once a week now that I wake up in the morning and I see some tweet of yours has gone like viral or semi-viral, and I'm always having to send something over and be like, oh, congrats. So there's a tweet that we'll talk about, which we're going to get into in this. But right before we hit record, I was just saying, hey, good job on that tweet. He goes, yeah, man, I'm trying to get like on your level, which is just Tim being nice to me, because my level of Twitter is like, I don't do anything for months at a time. And then I berate myself for not doing anything. And I try to start and then I don't follow through. I have a very bad consistency problem with Twitter. So what I was saying is, and I'm curious to kind of hear how you think about this too. Like, Twitter's interesting to me because I obviously can publish consistently. I do it every single week for work.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But I just never want to outside of work. And so I have this thing in my head where I'm like, oh, I'm so bad at Twitter. But really what I should be saying is, well, I shouldn't be saying that. I should be finding the way to get better at Twitter. So what I have is I have a couple of colleagues. All of us want to get into Twitter. And so we opened up a Slack channel and we're sending our tweets to each other before we publish them in order to, like, you know, just run them by each other, try to make them a little bit more pithy and stand out. But what it is for me is the accountability.
Yeah. And it's just like anything else, right? I suppose for what I'm doing, it's important to recognize that all of my Twitter is like specifically being measured in terms of the amount of email subscribers it's getting from my personal newsletter. And I am all for the Slack channels and stuff, but, and like the accountability groups and that kind of thing. But for me, it's actually been pretty damn easy because, you know, I wake up really early in the morning and, Hype Fury, man, like this is really one of the coolest apps I've ever found. It just makes publishing so simple. And when I wake up every morning, you know, I have like my little secret personal blog that is turning into something not so secret anymore. But I write on the blankpage.io and I get my morning writing out, and then I hit Hype Fury and schedule like 4 or 5 tweets for the day. And then my commitment to myself is 1 Twitter thread a week and then 1 long form blog article on Tim Stodds a week. And then my newsletter, which goes out to my Tim Stodds followers a week too. And I got to say, it's the threads really, like, threads are kind of barf worthy sometimes because you can tell that, you know, people find the catchy little headlines that like Sahil or something, if that's how you pronounce his name, forgive me if I got his name wrong. And then like you see these kind of waves of trends and like something starts working and then all of a sudden everybody is like, all the tweet threads look exactly the same. So yep. I'm trying my best not to be gimmicky with it. But man, like I've always been critical of social media for the sake of social media, but I will be the first. In the same way, I felt like I was wrong with, you know, what we were talking about with the newsletters and the advertising, you know, like I shouldn't say I was wrong. I am reevaluating how much value Twitter can bring to like my personal email list. And it's been a lot of fun and it's doing really well.
So that means it's working. You're seeing, and I mean, obviously I just said a minute ago that there have been a couple really great tweet threads that have gotten a lot of likes.
Yeah.
You're seeing the impact of that on your list too?
Bro, I sent my email out. It was 1800 something this morning. And before I started committing it, I'd say 2 months ago, I had 1300 subscribers. So I got 500 plus email subscribers.
That's good.
In a month.
30% growth.
Yeah. I mean, look, dude, it's like, as always, you know, there were 2 days in particular. I had 1 Twitter thread that went more viral than anything I've ever done. And so on those days, I got like 130 something subscribers. And then the second day, it was like 101, right above 100, you know? But for the most part, I'm getting like 8 to 10 new subscribers a day.
Was that the one where you commented on the woman who's like, yeah, you've never tried heroin? What did she say? She said like the most addictive drug is attention or something.
And you're like, or a salary, I think. Or I can't remember what it was. Yeah, the most addictive drug is a salary. And so, I mean, dude, that was one of those ones where you wake up in the morning and you're like, whoa, what happened here? But yeah, I commented. I was like, you've obviously never done heroin.
Was that the one? That's the one that's just gone crazy viral, or was it a different one?
No, it was a much different one. It was a thread. It was the thread that I wrote last week. Yeah. But no, that was funny. I enjoyed that.
Wait, you can't just leave that hanging. Wait, when the thread that you wrote last week, what thread did you write last week? And should we cover that instead of this one?
No, I want to cover this week's thread. I think this week's thread was a little bit... It's funny, too, because last week's thread, I didn't expect to do as well. I thought, you know, because I'm planning my content ahead of time. And so... Yeah.
Okay, so hold on a second then. And sorry to cut you off, but it's because this is something that I'm interested in and you're having some success with it. So I want to talk through it in more detail. You have already touched a little bit on your morning process, but I want you to take me through that just a little bit more. So you wake up and you write for the blank page,
mm-hmm.
which is a secret blog, no longer secret.
It's like not so secret anymore, yeah.
Then you open Hype Fury. Tell me a little bit about how you use Hype Fury. And like, where do you get the tweets from? Is that from what you just wrote an hour before, or where does that inspiration come from in the morning?
Yeah, a little bit of both. So what's cool about Hype Fury, and I think they really hang their hat on this, which is a great move for them, is most social media accounts are just scheduling accounts. But Hype Fury is like a content creation tool where it'll take the things that you've tweeted about that are most popular and pop up a new like version of that in a way. Or sometimes it'll even just pop up word for word one of the most popular tweets that you've done. And then I can take it, you know, think of a different way to say something. One of the things that it forces me to do, and I think this is actually an important concept, is like as writers, we think that we have to continuously like come up with new ideas and new ideas. And I can't remember where I heard it. I think it was Brian Clark actually that told it to me. He said, like, your new followers don't know about the stuff that you wrote about 4 years ago. You know, so I think one of the reasons that it's starting to get success is because I'm like more willing to kind of find different ways of saying the same thing over and over and over again. Mm. And so Hype Fury helps me do that because it, I guess you got to use it to see the dashboard, but it's not necessarily just a scheduling tool. It's like a, hey, here's an idea. And it puts them right in front of you so that you can sort of tweak the wording and mess with old concepts that you've already had success with.
That's interesting. Yeah, the concept of saying the same thing over and over again. I forget about that from time to time.
I know, me
boy,
too.
It really does seem so important. Like you try a lot of stuff in the beginning, you find something that's going to stick. And it's obvious when it happens too. I think for anybody who hasn't had this experience yet, it can be a little frustrating because you're not sure which, like people always say, like we should niche down and you should do one thing so people know you. Yeah. And it's really hard to know what that niche is going to be in the beginning. So I actually do think it's better to throw a lot at the wall, but then one day something's going to happen and it's going to get, like you said, it'll be shared way more than anything else you've ever written. And it'll become very, very obvious. You're not going to miss it when it happens. And then that's the thing that you double down on. And Jack Butcher said something about this, which always stuck with me too. It was very similar to what you just said, just like that, like 99% of being successful is having the patience to find ways to repackage the same idea over and over and over again. So I forget that for myself from time to time. And I think one of the reasons I've been resistive to like sitting down and doing the Twitter thing is that most of what I've published has been threads. And they're pretty deeply researched. It represents like a big amount of work in my head right now. Mm-hmm. And I need to find some good ways to kind of take that mental barrier down because you're right. There's a lot that I probably could just repackage and put out there. So that's cool. That's an interesting tool. But you said you're also pre-planning your content. Tell me a little bit about that too. So how do you think about this right now?
Well, it's just like you said, man. It was really like, I always had timstodds.com as a side thing that gave me some creative outlet, right? So this was like 5 years of just trial and error that I'm going to try to package through a couple of sentences. The whole reason why I started my Substack is just so that I always had that. You know, I just had a way where I could wake up in the morning. Like this morning, I just wrote about lithium mining and how like America basically is completely losing the race to mine these rare earth metals that we're going to need for the electrification of the world. And wrote about that. When I was in California, I wanted some really cool hikes and I took pictures and I wrote about that, you know? So it took me a while to just be completely okay with this is for me. And my timstodds.com, I'm just going to dedicate to business and marketing, build like a quote unquote personal brand. I was always just reluctant to do that because it felt stupid and gimmicky, you know, but it was Nat Eliason a while ago who wrote a blog post about how valuable his blog has been for him personally. And like, I always knew that, but I think I had a little bit of that imposter syndrome, you know, where it's like, nobody wants to take business stuff from me. I'm just going to write creatively about it. So anyway, making that decision was really, really important. Because it's so easy to say, I'm just going to write about whatever and whatever happens, happens. But that's not a good tactic to build like a real following. So that decision was important. Hey there, it's Tim. And I need to take a moment to tell you about this show's sponsor. It's a product called Hype Fury. When I was able to speak to Yannick, who is the CMO, one of the founding partners of Hype Fury, and he agreed to sponsor the show, I was so thrilled. And the reason is because I have personally used Hype Fury for the last 3 years, and it has allowed me to build my social media following and my personal brand to over 70,000 followers. I could not have done it without Hype Fury, and I really, really mean that. I use this product every day, and it's added so much to my business and to my life. So Hype Fury is a social media scheduling tool. It has three main features that I think separates it from every other tool. One, it allows you to quickly create content and schedule them. So it's a very nuanced feature, but it's so helpful. Basically, I sit down at my desk in the morning and I type out my tweet, I type out my LinkedIn post, and then all I do is I hit enter. And Hype Fury schedules it at the opportune time on Twitter and on LinkedIn. I don't have to think about it any more than that. All I have to do is sit down and create my tweets, create my posts, hit enter, and Hype Fury does all the work for me. Second, Hype Fury makes it so that you can easily create threads. And threads have been the biggest value add for me in growing my following. So threads really help me grow my following on Twitter. And those threads format themselves into longer form LinkedIn posts on LinkedIn. It's actually kind of funny. I made a video about this not too long ago about how, yes, like you want to create threads on Twitter. You want to be a thread boy, because I'd say like 80% of my growth on both Twitter and LinkedIn have been from threads and long form posts. And I wouldn't have been able to format any of this without using Hype Fury. And then third, Hype Fury is really good for keeping you inspired. So what it does is it shows you some of your most popular tweets and your most popular posts. And it basically gives you information. It gives you inspiration as to what your audience is looking for and what they most actively engage in. So you're never sitting at the computer thinking, oh man, like, what am I going to say today? What kind of content am I going to create today? It's constantly feeding you new ideas, new inspiration, and it allows you to quickly create this content so that you can continuously get yourself out there, continuously build your brand, and most importantly, turn that social media following into newsletter subscribers. So through Hype Fury, I've been able to grow my personal email list, timstodds.com, to over 30,000 followers. That's turned into a business within itself. It's really helped me grow the Copyblogger newsletter. We're at 110,000 followers right now. A whole lot of that is also because of Hype Fury. So please, this is a product that I use every single day. I personally vouch for it. You can check it out at hypefury.com, hypefury.com. And if you have any problems with it, you can send me a DM on Twitter, and I'm sure I can convince you as to why it will add value to your life. So hypefury.com. Thank you so much to Hype Fury for sponsoring the show. And let's get back to the episode.
The decision to split those two. So you have one that's the playground, one that's focused.
Yeah, well, for me, splitting the two was important. But really, the point that I think if somebody wants to take something away from this is building like a brand around yourself is very, very intentional. Like, it's really rare that you can just have a blog and write about whatever you want and have it stick. You know, it's not like I don't want to discourage people from doing that. I'm just saying from a pragmatic standpoint, like it was not my experience at all that you just have a creative blog and like, bam, it sticks. Like you kind of have to be about something.
Yeah.
And so then that brings me to, what am I about? And just like you said, I had to try a lot of things, and it seems like over and over and over again, there's a window that I have experience in, which is just old school service business work that isn't built on like quote unquote leverage. And, you know, you don't have to take money from people and raise a couple $1 million on some crazy idea. You get a client and then you get a monthly invoice and then you get another client and then you hire somebody, and just that systematic bootstrapping process of service businesses. Like every time I write about that, it seems like people grab onto it. And so for me, I'm finding my lane because I'm learning that like 95% of the people out there that want to try to make a living online aren't trying to create the next Facebook. You know, they're just trying to make that $10,000 a month mark that we always talk about. And so that's just sort of where I landed, right? It wasn't intentional, but once my blog and my newsletter and my social media, which is just Twitter for now, had like a lane, all of a sudden things started coming together.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I think what I struggle with, or what I go back and forth on mentally, is, and we've talked about this in the past a little bit, that feeding the beast thing, how you can get roped into a version of content creation that just constantly needs to be maintained. And there's a part of me that knows, I think I'm overthinking it for my personal stuff, because, you know, like I said, at work, we just publish every week. It doesn't really, you don't think a ton about, like, for my personal work, one thing that I think a lot about is, do I want to be somebody who publishes regularly on Twitter? Or do I want to be the kind of person who like disappears for a while and then comes back for maybe like 1 to 2 months a year when I have something new and important to say, and then just do bam, 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 tons of value, get all the attention, give everybody what I've got to give them, and then disappear again and be just like off their radar. And I'm not sure where I've landed. I haven't landed somewhere on that yet. I think I could tell you which I would prefer to do. Like my gut reaction is the second one, because that's more my style. I want to go away. I want to learn something new, like build something new, have something new to say, then come in, drop all these knowledge bombs and leave. I think it's possible to pull it off that way. At least what I've seen with like publishing threads is that they really do snowball. Like it's, yeah. So I've done detailed case studies of how people like Sahil have built their audience, and he's really good at consistency. 2 threads a week, every week for the last 2.5 years, 600,000 followers, right? What I haven't found yet is there somebody who can just kind of pop into existence, give you a thread a day for like 2 months about a whole new topic, blow your mind, and then disappear. And I think we've talked about him before, Tim Urban over at Wait, but why would probably be the closest I've seen to that.
Sure.
Because, and like, I love his headline, even his, you know, his motto is,
oh yeah, like every once in a while or something. Yeah.
Yeah. It's new articles every sometimes. And I'm like, that's, oh, I feel so seen when I see that. So anyways, it is something that I'm thinking about, but I think if I were advising myself, I'd just say, stop thinking, just go do it. Like, go do it enough that you have the audience, and then you can decide what you want to do. You can decide to dial it back later. But for now, I haven't been executing right. So I've got the accountability thing. It's cool to hear that you've got this system that works for you. We wanted to talk about this one thread today because you published a thread. I think it was this morning. Is it this morning or was it yesterday?
No, it was yesterday.
Okay. Yeah. It's already got like hundreds of likes. So I had it a second ago.
Yeah. I'm going to pull up this thread, but I'm also going to say to you, and I think this is for a lot of people, is sometimes, Ethan, like, I don't think you recognize that you're legitimately like the world's most authoritative resource on newsletters. And like, I'm not saying that to be gimmicky. Like, I don't think there's anybody in the world that has done more research than you on how this system works and operates and scales and fails. So, you know, I'm not necessarily saying that like, I think you should do that. I'm just saying that you have a really, really, really particular knowledge set, which is deep. And at this particular moment of time, like, I don't think you're ever going to find a better time to strike on that, you know? So yeah, you could do the Tim Urban style, or you and your buddies in your Slack channel can, you know what would be cool, man? Shit, I probably shouldn't say this because then we're going to be like, I guess we got to do it. What would happen if we started just like a consistency club with the people listening to this? You know what I mean? No. How do we just have like
what have you done, Tim?
Yeah, what have I done?
We'll
think about
it.
I don't know if I'm ready for that yet. We'll think about it.
Well, I mean, here's why we're both saying that, because it would work. We would totally both works. Be held, like, we would be held accountable, and everybody in it would be held accountable. So holler at us. We don't even know if anybody listens to this thing. So let us know what you think, besides the few thousand people that we know do listen to it. Mm-hmm. Just let us know what you think of that. We'll think it over. Yeah. I think it'd be cool. And I don't know. It fits into that model that we've talked about as well. You know, just with having your kind of your free content front end, back end, like communities and accountability communities in particular work really well as back end products. So I don't know. It's something to think about. I think it would work, which is why I'm hesitant. It would force me to work on a fairly regular basis, I think everybody listening to this might have a certain amount of resistance to, but yeah, it definitely has been working so far, even in the Slack channel.
Yeah, that's awesome. Let's get into it.
Let's talk about this thread. Yeah, you're going to pull it up. Are you going to share your screen so we can see it?
Sure. I like these episodes we do with the screen shares. I think they're really cool.
Have we heard anything from people? Do people think this is cool, or are they sick of us sharing the screen?
I've heard definitely from people, probably 4 or 5 people so far, just the other day. A guy named Kieran, who has been following me for a while, he said that the community episode that we did, where I talked about the transition and like how difficult communities would be, he was like, man, I really, really appreciated that. And I'm thinking about totally like flipping what I do, because I don't know if I'm ready to be on the hook with this, which makes me feel really good. You know, there's people that listen to us and actually take it into account. So it's working, man, for sure.
Awesome. All right. Screen sharing stays then. Okay. So I'm looking at this. Ridiculous 539 likes, 124 retweets, which is a hell of a ratio. That's wild.
Yeah.
You don't need to pay a university 50 grand to learn how to write. Here are 7 resources that'll do it for free. Let's go through it at a high level first. We'll just go bang, 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 bang. These are the 7 that you laid out. And then we can dig into some of the ones in particular, because I think some this community will already be familiar with, like Copyblogger, but others we may want to go a little deeper on. So take me through it from top to bottom, the 1 to 7.
Well, first I'll start with the headline, because that's like the most important part. I, my entire life, have been very, very, very critical of the education system. I've written about it. I don't need to go on one of my rants. And I feel like other people feel the same way. So I thought about that. Well, first off, even before that, this concept of a thread with writing has been doing really well over the last couple of months. I saw what Dickie was doing, and he's been dialing down into writing. Obviously, they got their product over there. Dickie Bush, by the way. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know what? I have some experience with writing. Let me do a thread about writing. So the headline grabs attention. It's something that I know. And it worked. So here are 7 resources that'll do it for free. Number 1 is Twitter accounts. I'm friends with these guys. So it says, number 1, Twitter accounts. Here are some good ones. At Wrongs to Write. Write is spelled WRITE. It's my friend Dakota. Writing to Riches. This is my buddy Charles. He's really cool. He's moving to Nashville, actually. I'm excited to like meet him and hang out with him. And then myself. I plug myself in my own thread because I'm meta like that. We tweet every day and pump out at least 1 thread per week. And this is my club, by the way. I'm in like a DM chat with these guys to keep
everything. Oh, so you got the whole, okay, all right. I wake up at 5 a.m. and write articles. You got the accountability thing going.
Hey, man, once you have a kid, 4:30 to 6:30 is just like the only quiet time I get. So it works.
All right. Okay, so that's thread number 1 is like, and what I want to do is we'll go back up to this and kind of
totally
talk through some of it, because what you really did here is you laid out a good framework, not only for learning writing, but for learning pretty much anything, which is like, who are the people you want to pay attention to? Who are the companies you want to pay attention to? And then like, what are the tools you're going to need? And there's a couple other things. So First one was some of the people. 2nd, Copyblogger.
I mean, obviously Copyblogger. I don't even think it's like overly cocky to say that we're still in the top 3 best resources in the world for like how to write online. So of course I'm going to put Copyblogger in there.
Mm-hmm.
Number three is Neil Gaiman, man. I'm excited to come back and talk about him because of what I've learned from him about how to write. Obviously, we talked about him last week. He's just one of my absolute favorite writers, but I've learned a lot from him as well. Number four, I put Grammarly. I think Grammarly is super valuable, and there's been this wave I've seen online of people kind of being anti-Grammarly, and let's get back to real writing and know how to structure sentences. And I think there's a point to that, but Grammarly is important because it's so specifically tailored to writing online. And so I'm going to get back to that one as well. Hemingway editor. You know, I haven't used Hemingway in a while because I have it kind of down point now, but man, short sentences, pithy sentences, like I spend so much time taking stuff out of my articles. It's like I write everything I can think of, and then almost all of it is taking stuff away. You know, it's like you mentioned Jack Butcher before. Like he's got this this really cool GIF that is the Statue of David, like slowly turning from like a big thing of stone into like a really beautiful statue. And mm-hmm. I really look at it like that. Like at first, you're chipping away big pieces of stone to get your sculpture, and then towards the end, it's like, could I use a different word here? Maybe a comma's over here. Is that a, could I make that a sentence? Or, you know, should I use a run-on even though it's not quote unquote correct to get my point across? So Hemingway editor taught me a lot about that in the beginning. I don't really use it too much anymore.
Real quick, just in case anybody hasn't seen that tool before, what you do is you copy and you paste your writing into it, and then it highlights it all up and it shows you what you could simply, like what's, where are you using long sentences? Where are you using complex words? What else does it do? It shows you, like, I think those are the two big ones, right? How do you simplify?
It also shows you if you could shorten your sentences. You know, like, that's, I think you're a Hemingway fan. Like, I've kind of been a Hemingway fanboy just because, you know, he was the typical, like, drunk writer that, like, locked himself away in the Florida Keys and wrote these amazing books, you know? But that was his style. That's what he did. That made him like one of the world's best writers. He sort of invented this like bam, 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 bam writing style.
You know, I heard an interesting story about how that came to be. Have you ever heard of the time that his wife lost his manuscripts?
No.
So when he was young, I mean, I think everybody knows Hemingway was married a bunch of times. And his first wife, they were living in Paris and he had gone to, I think, Germany or something like that for the weekend. And she was going out to meet him. And she brought his manuscripts with her out of the apartment that they were living in, packed them in a suitcase, put them on the train, gets to Germany. They're all gone. Suitcase is gone. Everything, all of his notes, all of his carbon copies, basically everything that he had written. And I think it was, you know, several articles and short stories, but there may have even been a first draft of one of his first novels. And this was at a time in his career when he was basically trying like hell to get that first novel written. Everything. Yeah. It's like, it would be like the equivalent of just losing every, like, I mean, your entire blog, your entire Dropbox backup, everything that you'd ever written anywhere was just gone. And at first he was crushed, but apparently when he went back to try and rewrite a lot of it, he just didn't have the memory for like the long flowery prose that he had made. Yeah. And that was when he really started experimenting with this sort of like shorter, more direct style. So in a lot of ways, she kind of made him in that moment by forcing that rewrite.
Isn't that so cool?
Yeah.
Just those moments that happen, you never know, right? And when you have those moments yourself and you start rethinking, like, is this a bad thing? Or 5 years from now, is this going to be like some kind of blessing that I didn't recognize? I love hearing stories like that. Okay, cool. Number six is Swiped. Man, Swiped is a cool website. It doesn't look that good. It's kind of clunky. Like, I'm always surprised that they designed it the way that they did. But, well, number six and number seven, actually, Swiped and then Marketing Examples / Copywriting Examples. Those are websites. It's the website's literally called Marketing Examples and another website called Copywriting Examples.
Are they both Harry Dry or no?
What was that?
I said, are they both Harry's? Or I know Marketing Examples is Harry Dry.
He runs that guy.
Oh, okay. Sorry. He's the guy who runs Marketing Examples. I'm just wondering if he also runs Copywriting Examples too.
No. This is probably the one that I go to the least, to be honest. I like the Grammarly blog a lot. I read that one. I also like the SEM Rush blog. Like those are probably the two technical blogs that I read the most. But I think it's important. I mean, look, there are certain things that work with copywriting, and I am absolutely not above like ripping off other people's things that have worked really well. And then, like, so I go to these, but if I'm ever stuck, like I'll go to marketing examples in particular. I've been to copywriting examples a few times. To be honest, I just put it on there because it's the sister website, but it's more marketing examples that I went to and swiped. Like, if I'm ever stuck, I'll just go there and find a headline that kind of catches my attention and just like rip it off in a way that that helps me. And like, I know that sounds kind of bad, but I actually really, really encourage people to find stuff that works and then just completely rip it off and like make it your own, because that's what this is. You know, it's like steal like an artist type thing. You got to learn from other people. Yeah. And so those are the seven.
All right. So let's just recap that real quick for people. So Twitter accounts you should follow, copy blogger, which is, what would you qualify that as? That's more like a community slash course, right? Or like slash education.
It's an educational company. Website. Yeah. I think that's the best way to put it.
Yeah. And so what I'm thinking of as I go through this is like, if I were to try and take this system and replicate it across any other topic, what is it that I would have to replicate? So the first is like, who is actively talking about this? That's your Twitter accounts.
Yep.
Second is what companies are out there trying to specifically teach this skill, whether it's writing or anything else. That's your second thing. Then what's interesting about Neil Gaiman is like, he is an operator. Yes. He's not out there like talking about writing in the same way that some of the Twitter accounts are that you mentioned before. He's a master of the craft who has talked about it in the past. And so maybe that's where I would go with that, is like, who's mastered this that I could learn from and has been interviewed. Then the tools thing is interesting, right? Because Grammarly and Hemingway, both of those are tools that you're going to use to get the outcome that you want. So again, I'm trying to think of like what the carryover would be. I guess, yeah, it's just tools you're going to use in the process.
Definitely. But
what's unique about these is they're not like, you could have listed a million different tools for writing. Those are specifically tools that almost give you an unfair advantage because they take some of the, they take some of the skill out of what it is you're trying to do. And I know you touched on this a second ago, so we'll get it deeper into Grammarly in a second, but let's just say for the sake of argument, if you're looking to learn something fast, like look for the skills that are going to give, or look for the tools that are going to give you the unfair advantage. And then what else was it? Swiped and
marketing examples.
Marketing examples. What would we call those? I'd call those almost like
inspiration.
That's the one.
Yeah.
So you got it. Who's
I go there when I'm stuck.
Yes. Yeah. Past examples that were successful. So I think that's an interesting sort of five-part framework. And I'll just say it one more time. It's like, who's actively talking about it?
Yep.
What education companies are specifically focused on it? Who are the masters that you could learn from? Mm. What are the tools that are going to give you the unfair advantage? And then where's the inspiration that you can use?
You're so good at this. Like, you're so good at breaking shit down into a process that you can use. Man, okay, like, we need to write this down. Say it one more time for me, because
we'll do this over and over again. I think that's a pretty solid way to go about
it. So solid.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what I like about this tweet, is I think you did a really good job, maybe even without realizing it, of touching all the different ways that you need to kind of branch out in order to tackle a new topic. So you seemed excited about two of these in particular. I want to go back to them just to give people more of your thoughts on them. One was Neil Gaiman. So you've learned a lot from Neil Gaiman.
A ton.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about what you've learned from Neil Gaiman? And specifically, like, I know you've consumed a lot of his stuff. Do you have a favorite interview with him, or like a favorite piece that other people should check out if they want to really absorb a lot about writing from him?
Perfect question. Yes. Neil Gaiman was one of the reasons why I wanted to become a writer. Frankly, I never knew that you could tell non-superhero stories through graphic novel until I read Neil Gaiman. A few of his comics in particular, just it's one of those moments where it's like, I never knew you could do this. And so like personally, he just really, really inspired me. What's great about him is he's a little bit more your style. He'll pop up for an interview like once a year, and then he sits in his cabin. I think he lives in Montana or something. And writes. And in particular, Tim Ferriss has an interview with him where even at the beginning of the interview, it's the only time I've ever heard Tim Ferriss be so excited to talk to somebody. He's like, I've been trying to get this interview done for years and years and years. Like, I'm so excited for this interview. It's amazing. First off, Neil Gaiman has like the best voice. And I really, really mean that. Wait till you listen to him speak. Like, he would be so good as a, I don't know what the term is. Like, his audiobooks, I think he reads some of them, you know, and I would listen to any audiobook that he spoke out, whatever the term for that is. It's very pleasant to listen to in that way. But he is a writer's writer. And what I mean by that is he's kind of, it's like in The War of Art where Stephen Pressfield says, like, going pro, right? Like, he's just a pro. And his process and his techniques have really, really helped me. And there's one in particular that I freaking love. And he says, when you sit down to write, you don't have to write. You can sit there or you can write, but you can't do anything else. And as soon as I heard that, it totally took that like distraction anxiety away from writing, because it kind of takes the pressure off. Because like, I can sit down to write and not write, and it's okay. Like, I can stare out the window or I can spin around in my chair for a little bit, but I can't do anything else. And then eventually I'm like, all right, you know, I can get a couple sentences. And then an hour later, I'm like, man, I got 400 words into this thing. The blog I wrote this week was an example. Like, the thing just turned out to be more than 4,000 words and I didn't plan for it. But I wake up early in the morning, I get my coffee, and I don't have to write, but I can't do anything else, you know? And that phrase has helped me so freaking much. And I really, really mean it, because there's two sides of writing. There's like, what am I going to say? And then there's saying it. And for a lot of people, I think the saying it part, like just getting the stuff out of your brain through your hands onto a page, is 90% of the issue. And so that phrase, like, you don't have to write, but you can't do anything else, is really groundbreaking for me. So yes, Neil Gaiman was a good one. And I'm glad that you saw that. I was excited about it because it really helped me.
I'm a big fan too. I'm not familiar with his graphic novels so much, but basically became a fan of his through Tim Ferriss.
Yeah.
And I totally agree. Great voice. I think two of my favorite books of his, one is the Graveyard book, which is, you've read it? Yeah.
It's so cool. It's like, he said he talked about that on Tim Ferriss as well. He got the inspiration from the Jungle Book. He was like, what if I did the Jungle Book, except everybody was dead? And I was like, holy shit, that's so cool.
Yeah, that's a great one. And then the other one was the treatment he did of Norse mythology. Sure. And I was never into mythology. I mean, I think it's cool and stuff, but I don't go out of my way to find it. But it's such a cool example of how storytelling transcends eras and like, yeah, the way a storyteller. So I guess just as a quick explanation, he retold all the old Norse myths of Thor and Loki and all these guys.
Yeah,
but he did it in his style. Yeah. And I didn't even know that was an option. Like, you're not allowed to retell the myths in your style, but it turns out it is. Yeah. So I loved that. What did you think of his take on writing by hand? Because I thought there was a point of his that was really interesting. At least I think this was Neil. He was talking about how he always writes. He drafts all of his books by hand. And one of the reasons that he did that was because he used to judge, what was it, like an annual writing competition. They would curate like the best, what was it, maybe fiction writing or something. One of these annual curations. And he said something to the effect of that, when word processors came on the scene, he started noticing a lot more bad writing.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think about that? And how has that impacted the way you write, if at all?
Yeah. And Chuck Palahniuk does the same thing. And I think about that often. And I think the difference is I'm always so anxious to get the thing written because it's very difficult for me to step away. And I think that's why I think I'm like trained as a millennial to sit down and like, I can't leave until this thing is finished. And he has a process where he doesn't have like a time limit. He just writes every single day until the book is done. And he doesn't necessarily know like what the outcome is going to be. Like we talked about last week, you know, where like you figure out what you're writing about by writing. Chuck Palahniuk does the same thing, and he did an interview on Joe Rogan once where this line really, really stuck out to me. He's one of my favorite writers as well. And he talked about when Joe Rogan said, like, he said, so you write everything by hand. He's like, you don't write it on a computer. And you could actually hear the disgust and the disdain in Chuck Palahniuk's voice where he said, no, he's like, that's not writing. That's typing. That as soon as you said it, I was like, oh man, am I not a writer? Am I just a typer? You know, I think it's really cool. Like I write in my notebook every morning, but truth be told, I've tried. It's difficult for me to get long, complex thoughts out in like a slow one word at a time thing. And I'm sure it's a skill just like anything else, but I don't know. I just get jacked up on caffeine and I type really fast. So it helps me.
I feel like they also don't make notebooks big enough for big ideas anymore. That's going to sound like a dumb, conceited thing to say. But here's the thing that I have trouble with is like when I'm working on a long or complex piece, I want a notebook that's like this big, like 2 feet wide by 18 inches tall, big enough to kind of map out all the ideas. And they're... I don't know what it is. I know they're out there, but I've just had a really hard time finding a paper surface that I really love for tracking a whole bunch of ideas really fast. The same way that you can with stream of consciousness writing, because you can stream of consciousness write real quick and then kind of let everything fall into its place later. Yeah. So I feel your pain there. Like I've been interested. I experiment with it too. There's a couple of articles that I've written longhand that I do like a lot. And then in particular, there was one time in Texas, we lost power for like 3 days, but I was still on deadline. I had to write for work. And luckily I had all the research already done. So it was really just a matter of putting everything together. And I did that by hand. And I was shocked by how long the day felt when I didn't sit in front of the computer at all. Like I had time to do all my work and a whole bunch of other stuff that I don't normally feel like I have time for. And yeah, you know what it is? This idea first occurred to me, which is that these screens are perfectly designed for one thing in particular. That is to get your attention and like to harvest as much of it as possible. And so all these tools, like, you know, social media apps, all that kind of stuff, they by design and by definition are going to make your day feel shorter because they're going to suck up as much of it as they can. So now, well, I'm not doing this right now because I'm kind of stuck on a little bit of a work treadmill. But what I typically try to do at my best is I'll do like a no screen Saturday type thing. And it's crazy how long that day feels. I don't know, man. It kind of makes me yearn for a time when like sometimes I think about it, just trying to make my money and then get off screens for the rest of my life if I could. I don't know. You ever contend with that?
Yes. And I've luckily come to peace with that, where that's basically my goal. Like I've just decided that there's no point in being half in and half out. Like, oh, the screen is sucking my life away. Like I'm just in until I'm out. And, and I'm really doing that. Like I'm in all the way until I'm completely out, where my job is just going to be more so like on the phone. I like being on the phone. Like I generally like the hustle and bustle of like business and talking and like, what's going on here? What's this problem? What's this fire that we got to put out? But yeah, eventually everyone is just going to be on the screen for me and I'm not doing it. So I have struggled with that. And I think about that too. Like, I guess it's the romanticism of, you know, like old English writers, you know, like how was like Dracula? Dracula was probably the first real novel I ever read that just sucked me in. Like I never knew you could do this. And that whole entire book was written by hand, probably like 50 times over. Right. Mm-hmm. And I do think about that quite often. Like, am I hijacking this writing process? But
yeah,
it's just the way it is. And so might as well go in.
Yeah. There is definitely an element of that. And I think one thing I try to keep myself from is that romanticism, because I mean, I definitely fall victim to it. But
yeah,
as you and any other working writer knows, it's like there's a lot. I mean, a lot of the romanticism is just a mirage. You know, people are successful at writing because they show up, whether it's
for sure.
handwritten or on a computer screen, like you do it long enough and you do it well enough. And what I mean by well is like you have to circulate it, your work well enough.
Sure.
And it's going to work. Doesn't matter how it's done. So I try to stop myself from being overly romantic about it. But then you see guys like Gaiman who still write by hand and you're
still doing it.
He's got this story of like staying at his friend's beach house while he finishes. I think it was, maybe it was The Ocean at the End of the Lane. What was he working on?
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
I heard that story
in the podcast too. And I think about American Gods as well. That book is long.
Mm.
That is a long freaking book. Mm-hmm. It legitimately must have been, I can't even imagine, like 40 notebooks full.
And I like how he, you know, he'll specifically pick notebooks for certain projects.
Yeah, so cool.
So I don't know. At this point, we're just kind of nerding out about Neil Gaiman, but I agree with you. There's a lot to learn from him.
Let's see if we can get him to retweet this, because it's definitely turned into like a Neil Gaiman fanboy episode.
One other thing that's kind of a fun resource for people who are trying to kind of absorb that slower pace of thinking and writing is John Steinbeck did this book. I think it's called, let me just grab it because it's right on my Audible, Journal of a Novel.
Cool.
Has this ever come on your radar?
Never heard of it.
Okay. So Steinbeck was obviously this like, you know, famous American writer. He wrote The Grapes of Wrath. He wrote a whole bunch of really influential work of Mice and Men. One of his biggest, and I think what he would have considered to be his most important piece, was East of Eden, which is this huge book. And he like frequently said that everything he wrote. I've never read it. You've read it?
Yeah. It's a masterpiece.
Okay, cool. Little known fact, when he was writing that book, which he wrote by hand, the way he did it was he had a big ledger, like a big notebook that his editor had bought him. And so he would open the notebook in the morning, and on the left-hand page, he would write a letter to his editor just to kind of get his brain moving and like talk about what's on his mind, what's going on in his life. And then on the right-hand page, he would do the day's writing. And he did that every day until the book was finished.
Wow.
And so what he sent to his editor was this big manuscript that was, you know, basically a couple hundred letters to the editor plus this masterpiece of a book. And somebody eventually split them out. So you can go read East of Eden, obviously, but you can also get the Journal of a Novel. And what's so cool about it is you kind of live through that process of what it's really like to put together a work that's that big.
Yeah.
And so you get all the ups, all the downs, like all the hard parts, all the doubt, the self-doubt, where like, here's this guy, he's one of the most famous writers in the country at that point, still not sure if he could do the project.
Yeah.
And so for anybody who I think aspires to writing as the craft, like as a craft, I just think it's so helpful to be able to go in and hear really what people think about when they're at the top of their game day to day. Because it's easy to admire somebody who's like pulled off this incredible feat. What you don't see is everything that went into it and like all the doubt and stuff. So that's a good one. Journal of a Novel. We'll link up to it in the show notes.
I love that. It's such a recurring theme on our show about how difficult writing is. You know, I want people to know that it happens to me every time. I publish an article once a week and it's just as terrifying now as it was before. I mean, the shit you write goes out to, well, what's trends? Like 20,000 people, you know?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard. And anybody who is at that spot, Steinbeck struggled with it and like literally documented his doubts and his fears. It's just, I love talking about this, and I love how it always comes around to just this process of shutting up the lizard brain, finding the muse, like Pressfield says, and just getting words on a page every single day. It's like, it's really cool. It's like a beautiful way to live your life, I think.
Beautiful, painful way to live your life.
Yeah, it's awful.
It's the worst and it's the best. Yeah.
I know.
Did you see that? I think you did. You saw it. I tweeted this. I don't know. I retweeted this meme recently where it's like a guy finds a book and it's like how to write. And he thinks he's going to be saved. And he opens it and it just says, right.
Right.
And he's like, oh, no. Yeah. This was a cool tweet, man. I think it's pretty clear that everybody got a lot of value out of it. So I'm glad we could go through it here. We'll link up to all these resources in the show notes for everybody listening. And let us know what you think. Obviously, not only of this, but you know what? Actually, even if you like the idea of an accountability club, lie to us and tell us you don't want one for now, because I don't think
I'm definitely not managing it. So let me put that out there.
Yeah, me neither. So that would be like the accountability club of Never Never Land, which would just be like the worst accountability club ever. No management, no adults in the room.
You know what? I'm not going to say it out loud. I got an idea. I got something a brewing that maybe we could do with this. But yeah, thank you, man. I'm excited to see my Twitter grow. It is a lot of fun. I will say.
What are you sitting at right now for followers?
Almost 6,000.
Oh,
I know. Damn. I smoked you. I even took a screenshot of when I passed you and I was going to send it to you.
Why didn't you? Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to catch up. First one to 20,000. That's what we're racing to. You, me, and then all the guys in my Slack channel.
Yeah. I mean, look, everybody has something to say. I don't need to repeat it. You know, like, you are a freaking expert at this. Like, I'm an expert at how to turn web traffic into clients. You know, like, I'm an expert at that one particular, I don't even know if you would call it a skill. It's not necessarily a niche, you know, it's just like a lane. Like, I really, really know how to do that. And I love sharing it. It's the ConvertKit thing, like, teach everything you know. Mm-hmm. And if you approach your writing with that methodology, I really don't think it's possible to fail, because somebody can learn from you. Like, it compounds. So yeah, I'm having fun, man. Thank you.
Yep. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. We will see you next week.
See you guys.